Residents of the Iowa town of Northwood are back in their homes today after being asked to evacuate yesterday. That after an explosion and fire at the municipal airport. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Before we find out about that explosion and fire yesterday in Northwood, Joyce Russell will tell us about which bills in the legislature made it through the funnel week. We'll also find out about taxicab safety after a rash of sexual assaults involving taxicabs in Iowa City. Blank Park Zoo's male Siberian tiger, Kabacha, dies of heart failure. And Des Moines Register sports columnist Bryce Miller in Sochi, Russia. We'll talk with him. Buckle up for your news buzz after this news from NPR. It's a Friday news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll find out about some taxicab safety after a rash of sexual assaults. Also, an update on that fire you probably heard about in the Iowa town of Northwood. Those residents are back in their homes today after being asked to evacuate yesterday. Also, we'll hear about the Blank Park Zoo's male Siberian tiger, Kabacha, who died of heart failure after a brief illness, and talk with Des Moines Register columnist Bryce Miller in Sochi covering the Olympics. We'll hear about his reflections and observations as the Olympics come to a close this weekend. But first of all, this week was the first funnel week at the Iowa legislature, a deadline hurdle for bills to make it out of committee if they have hopes of becoming law one day. Joining me now, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
Quite a list of things to get through. Interesting topics here. Let's start with the bills, if we could, that had the strongest bipartisan support.
Yeah, a number of bills that were always expected to pass. Bullying legislation to address bullying in the schools, expanding broadband, and also veterans assistance. But the broadband and the bullying bills, I think, still need some work, but they were top priorities, so they got pushed through.
We've been covering a number of bills here on Iowa Public Radio over the past weeks. You have, among other reporters. Let's talk about those. We've had a lot of talk about the facility for juveniles here in the state's facility. What's happened on that front?
Well, the Senate got their bill through committee that will mandate that the state operate rate of facility for delinquent juveniles. That got scaled back. Initially, the impetus was to reopen that home in Toledo, but what got passed was the state should operate some facility for delinquent girls. The conflict over that still is whether that should be a public facility or a private facility.
And Joyce, we've been hearing in the news also tasers, some bill having to do with the use of tasers by police in the future.
Yeah, there was some interesting testimony from police officers and others about the use of that. It's a control device, and there have actually been some fatalities in police departments in Iowa, or at least one police department in Iowa after the use of a taser. And so there's some interest in mandating some standardized training for this for police departments across the state.
Changing kidnapping statutes. Tell us about that.
Well, that was the statute or the kidnapping law that people felt needed to be changed because of the death of a northern Iowa girl at the hands of a kidnapper. That perpetrator then killed himself. But the idea was that if Iowa's kidnapping statutes had been tougher, then he would not have, he was, you know, jailed and then released on an earlier offense. And so this would get at that point in Iowa law that some people say would have prevented that tragedy from happening.
Sexual assaults in the Iowa National Guard we've been hearing about and work at the legislature on that.
Right. The National Guard, you know, like any military unit, has their standards and procedures for dealing with military sexual assault. There's very, very interesting testimony on the things they have in place to deal with that. And so this, the main thing that this bill would do is require the Guard to report that to the legislature so there's some more accountability there. There was an advocate for sexual assault victims who spoke at that hearing. I asked her how many, she's been going around the state talking to guard groups, and so I asked her how much of that she's hearing reported.
At every event I do, I have at least one, but that was exactly one thing that we wanted to gauge. We're really just looking at an improvement on the Iowa Code of Military Justice.
So this is a topic that really fits into a national theme of sexual assaults in the military.
Oh, yes, very much. And actually one thing that's going on is that there are new guidelines coming down from the Pentagon, and legislators and others are interested in how those are going to be carried out in the Iowa Guard.
Also, we've been reporting on radon testing. What's been happening there in terms of getting through the funnel?
Well, the bill did clear the funnel to mandate radon testing in Iowa schools. This is an issue that keeps coming back. Actually, there was a bill that would have gone to home construction to require contractors to put in you can do something to a home when it's being built that will keep the radon out, and that didn't pass. This year, the bill is to mandate schools to test for radon. And it's interesting, there was a lung cancer survivor who actually contracted lung cancer from radon exposure. She testified last year, and she was back again this year to testify on the issue.
Joyce Russell is with us, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent, talking about Funnel Week, a hurdle. A deadline for bills to make it to a certain stage in the process or not be considered anymore in this session. Let's talk about some of the bills we've reported on, some of the topics that have failed to make it through the funnel this week, Joyce. What's on that list?
Oh, well, a number of bills there. We reported on a bill that would have provided for new regulation of home daycares. Expanding online schools is also proved to be too controversial. Cell phone insurance, regulating cell phone insurance also didn't make it through the funnel. And probably the most high-profile issue that we reported on that failed was the bill to allow for medical marijuana. Again, some high-profile testimony, a couple of moms of epileptic children who believe that medical marijuana would be critical in treating their children. One of those was Maria LaFrance. She's from West Des Moines. And she had just heard the legislators say, well, this bill is dead for the session. We couldn't get the bipartisan support. And she would have nothing of that. Here's her remarks.
I must be very naive because the session is not over. And I'm hoping that we have some dialogue on this. If we can get a hearing in the Senate, we can get 26 votes. And I'm begging to push that through. It's on the Democratic platform.
Interesting testimony from a mother there, as you describe it. Again, here, a topic that has national importance, marijuana laws, changing rapidly across the country, and also it seems somewhat perhaps awareness or at least being talked about in our legislature.
Yes, and it will almost certainly be back next year.
Family treatment courts. Tell us about that one.
Well, we heard some testimony from a woman from Fort Dodge who really feels like her life was turned around by family treatment courts. It's a specialized court that puts intensive help on especially parents who are drug addicted and who are just about to lose their children. They've temporarily lost their children. And these courts just give them intensive treatment to turn their lives around. There's a number of these already. I think that there wasn't enough discussion of that to expand that. But it's clear that it's really making a difference in the lives of some of these people.
Mm-hmm. Limiting smart meters. Are these the meters we find monitoring our gas usage on our houses, for instance?
It is. And the rural electric cooperatives especially are using this technology where they don't have to get anywhere near the house to read the meter. They do that from the office, and they regulate. They can see whose electricity is out. They can see how much electricity you've used. And you know, the rural electrics are very keen on this, but it's raised some privacy concerns and safety concerns. But I think this bill didn't get very far. And I think that it's so well entrenched already in rural Iowa that I think that train has left the station.
Are there some bills, Joyce, that have passed through this funnel week that will never make it into law, or we can safely say they won't?
Well, almost certainly more partisan bills, preschool expansion and minimum wage laws in the Senate will almost certainly not pass the House. And similarly, a bill to ban telemed abortions may pass the House, but will almost certainly not even be considered in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. In the first case, Democrats behind that. In the second, the Republicans
right.
Behind that. Well, why pass a bill out of committee if it has no hope of becoming law?
That's a good question. It's something to campaign on. And in general, you know, these haven't passed the full chamber yet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there may be some impetus to not spend any more time on these when they're not going to become law. However, they do at least have it out there. There's a vote on it, and they can take that to the campaign.
Joyce Russell, any surprises here? Some bills perhaps that we didn't see as front and center that made it through nonetheless?
There were a couple of bills that were kind of under the radar through the session. A puppy mill bill. Senator Matt McCoy of Des Moines, a leading animal rights advocate, Iowa, a few years ago passed some bills to regulate, passed a law to regulate puppy mills. This bill would tighten that up a little bit. There's a bill that would come to the aid of state workers who have been taken off protected status and put on at-will lists where they can lose their job protection, and Democrats are unhappy about that. And then at the last minute, a bill passed to raise the speed limit for mopeds.
Mm, okay. We'll look forward to seeing what happens with that one. What about the gas tax that we've reported on for years here? Any movement there?
Well, two Democrats and two Republicans are meeting on that issue in the Senate. They have a plan for bringing it up, even though it didn't meet the funnel. They can attach it to a transportation appropriations bill. That bill is funnel-proof. So we'll see what happens with that.
Okay. So remind us. So we'll check back in, of course, on a number of these issues in our talk shows and in our reporting at Iowa Public Radio. But what happens to these bills in the coming weeks? What will you be following?
Well, they'll have to get through the chamber of origin. So bills that passed House committees have to make it through the full House, over to the Senate, and through a committee in the Senate. So we'll be seeing a lot of floor action now to get these bills moving, get them over to the other chamber, and then another crunch time for them to get through the opposite chamber through a committee.
Mm-hmm. Joyce, the last time we spoke, you said that because it's an election year, we're expecting the legislature to adjourn to recess on time. I guess that would be sometime in May. Are you still sticking with that prediction?
Yeah, I think they're pretty serious about wrapping things up quickly this year.
Okay. Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell, thank you for keeping us up to date on happenings there in Des Moines at the legislature.
Okay. Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday morning, you probably heard that residents of Northwood, that's an Iowa town near the Minnesota border in Worth County, were asked to evacuate after an explosion and a fire originally thought to contain sulfuric acid broke out at the municipal airport. Sergeant Scott Bright is with us of the Iowa State Patrol. He's also Public Information Officer at the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Sergeant Bright, welcome to our program.
No, thanks for having me.
So yesterday it was reported widely, also throughout the country, that this explosion and fire involved sulfuric acid. What have we determined now?
Yeah, what is determined today is after the investigation, apparently the sulfuric acid was in a different building where the fire took place. It was a building about 50 feet from where the fire originally started, so we're very thankful for that. There was some fertilizer in the building that was on fire, and I think the main thing was it was a precautionary issue to get the residents out of the town.
Okay, so we did have some burning chemicals, but not the sulfuric acid, which was a big concern.
That is correct. That was a major concern. If it was sulfuric acid, we had to get people out of there quickly. And we did have some fertilizer in that building that was burning. But after the investigations, we have determined that there was a building approximately 50 feet away from the fire that contained a lot of these chemicals. And the firefighters did a great job of not allowing that fire to reach that building.
Mm-hmm. And those fertilizers that burned, did they pose any toxic problem in the air?
Just a little bit. We had four people that went to the hospital stating they had some breathing issues, so I believe that was part of the reason why they went there, because they breathed some of the smoke in, and we're just thankful that it wasn't as serious as it sounded to be.
Right. It sounds like a great precautionary measure to get residents out of town, ask them to leave town, even though, as it turns out, thankfully, it wasn't as grave a danger as was originally thought it was. 1,900 residents in this town, right?
Yeah, it's approximately around 1,900 people, and you know, we evacuated. I heard roughly around 300 people were down at the Kinset Community Center. We had a lot of family members that actually stopped by and picked up family members in the town and took them to their residence. So we felt we did a great job of evacuating the community, and we're just thankful that it didn't turn any worse than it was reported.
How did the evacuation run? Was this a case of police going door to door, or how was that communicated?
No, it wasn't a mandatory evacuation. We set up a stage at the sheriff's office where they brought school buses in, and people that wanted to evacuate were given a ride down to the Kinseth Community Center. So it was not a mandatory evacuation. People were notified and were aware of what was going on, and if they wanted to leave, then they had that opportunity to do that.
Now that it's determined that sulfuric acid was not part of the fire but was nearby, are there any open questions that are still being investigated at this point?
I'm sure the investigation is going to be ongoing, and we're just very thankful that that building that was 50 feet from this fire did not catch on fire, because it would have been a lot worse than it was.
Do we know what sparked the fire, the explosion?
They're looking at it now. I mean, they discussed it, and it's possibly a propane tank erupted and caused the explosion. That's what started the fire. That's what the investigators are looking at now. So after a few more hours of investigation, we should be able to find out the actual cause.
Of course, I've been following the news here for some years. I have a hard time remembering the last time when an Iowa town was evacuated in this fashion. Have there been other previous instances?
I've been in this job for 24 years, and I can't recall. I'd probably have to get on the computer and kind of Google and see if we've ever done this in the state of Iowa before, but I can't recall if we've ever done this before. We're just very thankful that it went very smoothly. We didn't have anybody hurt seriously, and that was our number one concern, was the residents of Northwood.
Okay. Sergeant Scott Bright of the Iowa State Patrol, Public Information Officer with the Department of Public Safety. Thank you for your time, Sergeant Bright.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Earlier this week, we learned the Blank Park Zoo's male Siberian tiger died of heart failure. That was after a brief illness. The deceased tiger, known as Kavacha, was 15 years old. He'd been in Iowa since 2001. Joining us now to tell us a little bit more about this huge cat, Kavacha, Kevin Dries is the director of animal care and conservation at the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. Hi, Kevin.
Hello there, and thanks for your interest in Kavacha and tigers.
I'm sorry to hear about the loss of Kavacha. What can you tell us about Kavacha's personality and the type of tiger he was?
Kavacha, like you said before, he was a male Amur or Siberian tiger, and he wasn't an extraordinarily big one. He weighed just under 400 pounds, for a male Amur tiger, that's an average-sized tiger. But Kavacha was really a magical part of our animal collection at the zoo, and he had been, like you had mentioned, since 2001. And he actually did interact with the public through a glass viewing window.
Well, what would he do, for example, for viewers?
Oh, paw at the glass. Not in an aggressive way, not like claws out, I'm going to attack, but it was basically a way, I think, to surprise visitors and get a reaction out of visitors, where he would stretch all the way up on his hind legs and scratch at the, paw at the grass at the highest corner at the top.
When did you first notice something was wrong there at the zoo with Kavacha?
Well, for the last couple of years, Kavacha's had a sensitive digestive system. And so we had always been watching Kavacha that way. But really, about a week ago, he really did stop eating. He couldn't keep food down. The veterinarian suspected intestinal blockage. And so he had a first surgery, and they removed the blockage. And the surgery was successful, and the blockage was removed, but he did not begin to eat again. And so it was actually during a second surgery to see if the intestine had recovered from the blockage. His heart stopped during the surgery.
Now, I understand Kavacha and your zoo's other Amur tiger, a female named Goldie, never produced any offspring. Do you know why?
We don't know why. And they had been together since 2001 with tigers. They do live singly in the wild. They don't live together all the time. They only come together for a few weeks during the year. And so after a few years of no conception, why we started to manage them separately, where we had different holding stalls or bedrooms in their building, and they had separate ones except for the times when Goldie would give a signal that she was in estrus. And then also the female, you know, she's actually a little older, 17, but after a female has not reproduced and she gets older, actually her fertility goes down. You know, it may have been related to that also. Mm-hmm.
So it's sure that you'll get a tiger or maybe more than one?
Whether it will be a companion and just display animal for Goldie, or whether it will be a new younger male that will be a breeding animal with a different female years down the road, we don't know yet.
Now, Amur tigers are very much in danger. How many are left in the world?
In the wild, there are probably less than 3,200 tigers altogether. Now, you have to bear in mind that there's six different subspecies of tigers, of which the Amur is only one. And if you just look at the Amur tiger subspecies, they estimate there's less than 350 in all of the wild. And actually, in AZA-accredited zoos, there are almost that many, you know, in the captive situation.
So what needs to be done to save this species from extinction?
The Amur tiger kind of proved that it can do it if it has the habitat, because actually in 1940, after years and years of pursuit by hunters, they estimated there was only 40 Amur tigers left in all of Russia. But during the Soviet Union rule, they actually had high penalties for poaching, and basically there wasn't that much development, and the population increased up to several hundred cats. But now since the 1990s, it started to go the other way as the Soviet Union started to develop logging roads, and so actually people use those roads to infiltrate the forest. And it isn't just to kill tigers, it's also to hunt deer and prey items of tigers, and so there's low prey density for the tigers. And as you can imagine, you know, tigers that big eat a lot of food, and so they need a large territory and a lot of prey. So there are several things that are working against tigers at the time, not of which is the development of Russia.
What happens to the body of Kavacha now? Is it laid to rest somehow? Or?
You know, it varies depending on the animal, but for Kavacha, his skeleton is going to be preserved at the anatomy lab at the Iowa State Veterinary College. I look at it this way, you know, when the tigers are here at the zoo, they're educating people by the opportunity to view them and watch their behavior, and then they continue to be educational resources for people even after they've passed on.
Okay. Kevin Treese, Director of Animal Care and Conservation at the Blank Park Zoo. Kevin Treese, thank you very much, and very sorry to hear about Kavacha, but we hope that Goldie will have a new companion, or at least another tiger roaming around soon.
All right. Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Keefe. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back in the second half of our program, we're going to be talking about a rash of taxicab assaults. We'll talk with Carla Miller of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa about a series of assaults. Also, a new project here at Iowa Public Radio that looks to investigate emergency room hospital costs, and we'll be asking you, our listeners, for input on that. Also, Bryce Miller joins us again. He's the Des Moines Register sports columnist in Sochi, Russia. He'll tell us about some of the experiences he's had over the last couple of weeks in Russia. He's covered six Olympics, and we'll ask him what stands out for him about this one.
People have had experience covering Winter Olympics, so they've never seen cross-country skiers in short-sleeve shirts.
Bryce Miller of the Des Moines Register, a conversation with him coming up. We'll talk to him in Sochi, Russia in the second half hour. And finally, I hope to get to this story of the elusive Twix bar that got an Iowa veteran fired. If you want to stay tuned, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a News Buzz edition. Stay buckled up. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A little later in the program, I'll be talking with Des Moines Register sports columnist Bryce Miller. He's in Sochi, Russia. We'll have him tell us a little bit about his experiences at the Sochi Olympics. But first, Iowa City Police are investigating three sexual assaults recently in which female victims have reported being assaulted while passengers in area taxi cabs. Joining me now, Carla Miller, Executive Director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa. Carla Miller, hi.
Hi.
We wanted to use these taxi cab assaults, these alleged assaults, as a jumping off point to talk about safety when taking a taxi cab. On these specific cases, three separate victims told the police that a cab driver, described in all three cases as a middle-aged non-white male, made unwanted sexual advances after picking them up. Now, the three women escaped unharmed. Can you add anything to the way you understand what's happened here?
You know, I think in general, we have had reports in the past regarding a cab driver. And going right to looking at perpetrators, they tend to find occupations where they can have access to victims. I remember when I was first with the Rape Victim Advocacy Program as a director around 81, there were some assaults by a cab driver. I think the Iowa City Police has done a real good job in these cases and in some that were just a few years ago of trying to screen people to make sure that they don't have a past that's going to predict or make the risk higher that somebody will be assaulted.
Does that vary from community to community? Is it depend on the community and the police force there to step up to the plate and say the taxis in our city will have drivers who have somehow been screened?
Right. And we do have a screening process here. But regardless of how you screen for people, most sex offenders don't show up on anybody's radar. Most offenders don't get caught, and if they get caught, don't end up on the registry.
These instances of alleged sexual assault are under investigation in Iowa City, but perhaps we can close by having you tell us what are the things that we should keep in mind, I suppose especially women, when you call a cab to make sure or as sure as possible that you're going to have a safe ride.
You know, I think that there are many things that we can do, and it will take the whole community helping the police to be able to make advances in this case. And that is, you know, not just looking at what women can do, although that's very important. If there's an inappropriate comment, if there's an inappropriate act that's reported, even if it seems minor, I think that also traveling in pairs, you know, and the police have a nice list of things that they put out to be safe, and that's noticing the license in the cab, noticing what cab company it is, you know, maybe taking a picture of the license plate. But that also means that bystanders can do that as well. If you hear something, if a woman gets out of a car, is upset, or is going to get into a car that something makes you uncomfortable, that people intervene as well. Ask questions, take pictures, report stuff, even if it's minor. That is how we're going to really make progress, is if people take action. And I'm not saying that you go up and intervene physically with the guy. I'm saying that, you know, you do other things that you can do. And the big thing right now is reporting to police.
Carla Miller, Executive Director of the Rape Victim Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's talk a moment about the launching of a new project here at Iowa Public Radio News. It's a project that looks to investigate emergency room hospital costs. Joining me now to tell us about it, two of my colleagues. They're heading up this project, Iowa Public Radio's Emily Woodbury, talk show producer, and Iowa Public Radio reporter Duri Buscarin. Duri and Emily, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Duri, tell us about this investigative project.
Well, we're really excited. Emily and I were working together through a talk show and our reporting to really look at the true cost of healthcare, regardless of insurance, regardless of if you're on Medicaid or Medicare, but how much those procedures actually cost when you're in the emergency room, when you go in for a heart attack, how they're different in different hospitals.
So one hospital, even in the same town, one hospital can be much different than another one?
Absolutely. Some hospitals are teaching hospitals. Some hospitals tend to serve a lot of Medicaid patients. And because Iowa's Medicaid reimbursement rates are so low to physicians, the hospital has to make up the price in some way. We found out that in Iowa City, the billing price for a heart attack discharged alive with minor complications, there's a $10,000 difference in how much they'll bill to Medicaid between two different hospitals in the same town.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just the hospital as a whole, but you're focusing on the emergency room. Well, why the emergency room?
Well, we're using the emergency room as a catalyst for this conversation because the emergency room, when you're there, it's such an emotional time. It's a scary time. It's unplanned. So you kind of leave the judgment up to the doctors and professionals you're working with, which makes it hard to predict or control your bill. You know, there's not a lot of room for questions or, you know, Do I really need this x-ray? Because, you know, it's an emergency and you're scared. And sure, I mean, when it comes to a life and death situation.
An example I had at the emergency room years ago when one of my boys was smaller, fell off a slide, had a half-inch cut in his chin, took him to the emergency room, thought, well, let's have this done right rather than have a scar there. It was happened to be a Sunday. There was actually just a little adhesive put on this to glue the cut back together, a little Band-Aid. But I was surprised a couple weeks later. We received a bill for, you can imagine, close to $1,000.
Yes, and that's just it, Ben. You know, some of the stories we'll be looking at will involve someone in the ER for cardiac arrest or some type of life-threatening situation. And in those cases, you're not going to be asking lots of questions in the operating room. But in cases like the one you just mentioned, where the injury is less severe, you have time to ask questions to determine whether it's worth it to have your hand cleaned, to take an over-the-counter pain medicine that may end up costing you, you know, $15. Those are situations where you can ask questions and say, maybe I don't need that procedure. And that's our overarching goal in this project, to create transparency between hospitals and ER patients and to educate healthcare consumers.
And you, in this, the neat thing about this project, I understand, is that you're going to rely on our listeners right now to chip in examples like we've been mentioning from their personal experiences, Duri.
Absolutely. We want to hear their stories. Even if someone has a copy of an itemized bill, they want to send us so we can look into the costs. We can't pay the costs, but we can help them.
Let's make that clear.
You get a big turnout for that one.
Yeah. But we want to help listeners understand what's going on here, hear about their experiences, and hear from even paramedics or people who work in the healthcare industry about why these costs are the way they are and how patients can be better informed to make good decisions on what kind of care they need.
And to reach us, to send us these stories, you can email us at investigatethis@iowapublicradio.org. Give us a brief idea of a time you went to the ER as a patient or bill payer. You know, what did your bill look like? We want to hear some charges that stood out to you and hear any questions you have on those charges. And in turn, we're going to look into some of those costs to find out why they are the way they are and where that money's going. You can also send these questions to Twitter at IPR Talk. You can message us on Facebook. You can join our Public Insight Network. You'll find a link to our Public Insight Network at the bottom of our homepage. And again, the easiest way to send in your responses, email us at investigatethis@iowapublicradio.org.
Okay. Iowa Public Radio's Emily Woodbury and Duri Bouscarin, thank you very much. I look forward to talking to you in a few weeks, to hearing about real-life examples from Iowans who've been to the emergency room and then looked at the bill and said, what's this? Right?
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a News Buzz edition. 2 weeks ago, as the Winter Olympics commenced in Sochi, Russia, we talked with Bryce Miller, the Des Moines Register's sports columnist, who is reporting on the Olympics. And let's talk with him once again as we're about to close these 2014 Winter Olympics. Bryce Miller in Sochi, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing great. How are you guys? I understand it feels more like winter there than it does here at the Winter Olympics.
It could be weather, a big headline there. Not the best of weather for some of the alpine skiing events and some of the other winter events. But first, also hitting the headlines here has been the flare-up in violence, the deaths. Some say Ukraine, neighboring Ukraine, on the brink of civil war. Is that at all being talked about at the Winter Olympics?
You know, I don't think you're getting as much discussion on something like that, to be honest, just because you're so isolated here. You really feel like you're in a bubble, whether you're covering or competing or whatever your involvement is in the Olympics. It really is even difficult if you're at a certain event. You know, I've had people ask me, what did you think about what Shaun White did today, or what did you think about what happened with Bodie Miller? And I could say, well, I can tell you everything that happened today at bobsled, but I haven't had access to, you know, a TV or, you know, a lot of any time to really look through headlines. So I think that isolation kind of keeps people away from some of those headlines until they get home and can really kind of digest it. It hasn't been something I've heard discussed here.
I remember watching some news footage of Dan Gable, our 1972 gold medalist in the Summer
right.
Olympics, you know, talking about it, and he was almost at times seemed oblivious of the terrorist action there. I think probably oblivious is too strong, but it was clear that as athletes and people covering athletes, you are in, as you said, a bubble.
Yeah, and Dan Gable's talked to me about that too. That was the Munich Games. And there was, you know, the tragedy involving, you know, Israeli participants. And he didn't really, he felt a little bit the same way. You know what's going on in your corner of the world, but one thing we've noticed here that's a little bit of that, the security level's been very, very high. I think the comfort level of people feeling safe at this Olympics is much higher than I would have expected coming in, and kind of now living it and seeing how they've changed up some of those plans from day to day to be both kind of thorough and unpredictable in terms of that kind of net of protection. I think people have felt better about safety here than at least I would have expected.
Let's talk a little. You mentioned the weather, skiing on slush or icy conditions in the fog. How much has the warm, less than ideal conditions for the outdoor winter sports events impacted what's going on among the athletes?
Well, it's, you know, obviously the indoor events down by the Black Sea and the coastal cluster area, as they call it, aren't really affected by that. But up here in the alpine areas, some snow has created some situations where I know a lot of people who've had experience covering Winter Olympics, so they've never seen cross-country skiers in short-sleeve shirts and, you know, little things like that. But there hasn't been as much natural snowfall. But it's been strange, depending on what venue we're at. The other night, the first night of women's bobsled, I know people were at a place called Extreme Park where they have snowboarding and moguls and aerials and all those events, and it was snowing these huge, huge flakes. We were just down the mountain, not very far away in the bobsled venue, and it was raining. I know they were talking about skiers who started at the top of courses in snow and finished at the bottom of courses in rain. So even, you know, from venue to venue up here, it's felt a little different.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned bobsled. We bring to mind Lolo Jones. You've been covering her in the bobsled, missing a medal, though, huh?
Yeah, she finished 11th. She was in the USA 3 sled. They ranked them 1, 2, and 3. So because she was in the USA 3 sled, expectations were pretty low. A rookie pilot, a woman named Jasmine Fenlater, and for them to contend for a medal would have been a bit of an upset. They've had some World Cup success and have been on the podium, but weren't expected to be in the mix here. But the U.S. had, you know, one of their best Olympic, you know, bobsled runs in history. I know on the men's side, Stephen Holcomb broke a 62-year drought in two-man. And then on the women's side, they won two of the three medals. Alana Myers won silver, and Jamie Gerbel won bronze. So Lolo Jones, and a column I wrote in today's Des Moines Register, and it's on DesMoinesRegister.com, I thought Lolo was just surprisingly happy and upbeat and bubbly because as an isolated track athlete in a single event, I don't think she's really experienced a team like this. And to see so many of her teammates succeed and some of that pressure be off her, I really think she enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Of course, one of the big disappointments for the host nation, Russia, eliminated from hockey by Finland a couple of days ago. Interested to hear any reaction from your end to that. Is it fair to say that this is the one medal that the host nation, Russia, wanted above all others as a gold medal?
Absolutely. I mean, no question. You guys have probably seen this. I've seen a lot of social media activity on the photos of Putin with his kind of hands on his head and even mascots. And this was a huge disappointment. One of the areas, I'm up in the mountains now, and there's a hotel that's got a little bar and restaurant in the front. And somebody that works there that we've got to meet, he said it was just, this was their worst day in the Olympics, because he said really the whole country felt disappointed because expectations were so high. With NHL stars like Ovechkin and Malkin, and they just expected to do so much more in this tournament and to get knocked out before the medal round. I think you're absolutely right. That's their scenario of the worst disappointment that they could have competitively at this Olympics.
The United States at the top of the medal count, but surprisingly, I wanted to ask you about this, that the Netherlands, many asking, here at least, how in the world is the Netherlands, a flat country not known for any mountains, pulling down many more medals than major powers with many times their population?
Well, one, it starts with them dominating speed skating. They've always been a country that's done that, but they've hauled in a lot of medals related to speed skating. There's a USA Today sports reporter named Gary Mahokas that works here, and I think he had a good line that I think he used on Twitter that captured a little bit of that. If in hockey the rink was a lot longer, the Netherlands would win that too. I mean, there's just that country's their ability to skate over long distances. I think a lot of it's just tradition built up over time, and that's their baseball, that's their NFL in some ways. It matters there a lot, and so there's a lot of involvement, a lot of training, a lot of support, a lot of tradition, and speed skating is just. To watch them compete, and I was there a couple of nights when it happened. They're far and away the best country in terms of that Olympic sport.
You have covered a number of Olympics. Remind us how many Olympics you have been at.
This is number six.
How will this stack up against the other ones that you've covered? For instance, what will stand out for you? We've mentioned the weather. That will certainly be a hallmark, unfortunately, of this for many events.
Yeah, and I think this one will stand out for all the stories along the periphery, all the tangential issues. I thought that after kind of a slow start, and I think a lot of people heard the concerns and complaints about a little bit of the substandard construction or hotels not open, and I literally had at the bobsled venue the other day, I opened a bathroom door with my hand, and the entire door came off in my hand. There's a little bit of that, but it's everything from the weather, the issues about stray dogs and how they're handled here, questions about anti-gay rights legislation and the stance of the Russian government and Putin related to that, the terrorism concerns leading in with the bombings across the country in the months, weeks leading up to the games. I just think it's one of those Olympics that's had a lot of discussion about things that aren't events, and I don't think when you're the host country that's what you want, but I think the majority of the time we've been here, it's felt like a pretty well-run Olympics, other than some of those little construction gaffes and small things. I mean, the buses run on time, the events have come off mostly without a hitch, on down the line. So I think Russia's done a pretty good job, but the storylines outside of competition, I just don't remember an Olympics that I was involved in that had so many.
Bryce Miller, before we end this conversation, let's go back to sports and have you tell us about an exciting moment that you haven't mentioned that you've witnessed in the sporting field.
You know, I was at that early round hockey game between the U.S. and Canada, women's hockey. That might be the very best rivalry at the Olympics. Those two countries are so far and above anybody else. The number that blows you away, there have been 19 world championships or Olympic championships, and Canada and the U.S. have won all of those. And they really don't like each other either. They had 7 pre-Olympic exhibition games leading into the Olympics, and in 2 of those, fistfights broke out. So they're by and far, in a way, the best teams in the tournament. They don't like each other, and that game was – It was 3-2. The U.S. led a lot of the way. There was a controversial goal that was allowed potentially after a whistle. Just for all of that backstory and backdrop, it's maybe the best rivalry at this Winter Olympics.
Bryce Miller, thank you so much for this conversation, and we hope you stay well the last few days of the Olympics, and we'll look forward to welcoming you back to Iowa soil.
Hey, thanks a lot.
And finally today, it's a story reported by Clark Kaufman of the Des Moines Register. And we've all been in this situation. You have hunger pangs at work and you put your money in a vending machine. That spiral holding back your snack rotates, but your treat refuses to drop. It just hangs there, tantalizing. Well, for most of us, that mini drama usually ends in defeat, but not for Robert McKevitt of Spirit Lake. It was a victory over an uncooperative vending machine that ultimately cost him his job. He was working the second shift at Polaris Industries warehouse in Milford when he decided to take a break for a snack. This was last fall. He says he deposited a dollar in the vending machine, selected a 90-cent Twix bar, which failed to drop. And at first, McKevitt did what many of us would do. He banged on the side of the machine, tried rocking it back and forth. When that didn't work, McKevitt, according to the state unemployment compensation records, walked away and commandeered an 8,000-pound forklift. He drove it up to the vending machine, lifted it 2 feet off the concrete warehouse floor, and let it drop, and allegedly repeated this maneuver at least 6 times, by which time 3 candy bars had fallen into the chute for his retrieval. And when a supervisor confronted him, McKevitt allegedly explained he was simply trying to get the snack he'd paid for. McKevitt was fired 5 days later. And in a ruling that became public last month, a state administrative law judge denied his claim for unemployment benefits, saying that McKevitt had demonstrated a willful disregard for his employer's interests. McKevitt served in Afghanistan with the Iowa National Guard in 2011. He didn't testify at this December 16th unemployment benefits hearing. McKevitt did tell the Des Moines Register, though, he never lifted and dropped the vending machine. He says after shaking the machine to retrieve the elusive Twix bar, he simply used the forklift to move it back into place against the wall. That's it for River to River, a NewsBuzz edition on this Friday. I'm Ben Kiefer. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Help today from Rick Fredrickson as well. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.